Lesson 34. Isn't it good to speak a foreign language? Text A. You really are a lucky dog. Many people assume that admission into the Institute of Foreign Trade means not only a farewell to unemployment, but also a hearty handshake with affluence. They say, and I quote, "As soon as you graduate, you will have a fair chance to go abroad. You may fly round the world, see exciting things and exotic places, and feel as happy as a lark and as proud as a peacock." I didn't know what to think when I first came to this institute. Happy? Yes, happy that I had been admitted by this splendid institute of higher learning. I started to dream about the many things I had so excitedly heard from those who like to dream. I fancied myself posted to one of our commercial offices overseas, working in carpeted offices with air conditioning and delightful social activities and parties in the evenings. "What would you like, tea or coffee?" I would answer with a nod, "Brazilian coffee with Danish milk, please." And trying to make conversation, I would say, "What lovely Mediterranean weather we are having." Sometimes, however, I felt a bit uneasy. Comfort is not the only thing in life, you know. I do care about what people may think of me, particularly those scholarly people who might turn up their noses at the mere mention of the word trade and frown at me, taking me for a little money-grubbing vulgar merchant. Well, a year at this institute has taught me a great many things. First, it is not at all easy to be trained for the Foreign Trade Service. Like the students of all other institutes, you must work hard, be straight in all your dealings, staunchly patriotic, loyal and 100% reliable. You must get a good command of two foreign languages, and Chinese, and try in every way to broaden the range and scope of your knowledge, which you may have to draw upon in your future work, history, geography, culture, and so on and so forth. Let me cite one or two examples to show how important it is to know the customs and culture of different countries. Once, one of our corporations wanted to sell washing machines to Arab countries. In an advertisement to promote sales, strategy demands diagrams instead of written instructions. Dirty clothes went into the machine in the first diagram. A thorough washing was illustrated in the third, simple and clear. But the result was disastrous. Arabic is written from right to left. How can this corporation expect to promote sales with dirty clothes as a result of the new machine? Another example concerns trademarks. One of the best batteries produced in China is the White Elephant battery. In English, however, white elephant means an object that is useless, overpriced, and utterly undesirable. Do you think English-speaking people would be inclined to make a large purchase of this white elephant? Second, I've come to learn that the life of a foreign trade worker is not exactly what most people think it is. A good foreign trade worker is one who is dedicated to his work. He must have a strong sense of duty and be fully aware that a slight mistake may bring colossal losses to the country, both politically and economically. My uncle, for instance, happens to be a foreign trade worker. Since he is very busy, my aunt has to do nearly all the housework. He is often disturbed in his sleep because of the heavy responsibility. Sometimes he goes to dinner parties four times a week, or even twice a day, but his duties as a translator prevent him from partaking in these banquets. I've seen many of his colleagues burning the candle at both ends. They seldom go to theatres. They seldom go to concerts, and they can't even afford time to watch a football match which they're very much interested in. They always think of the interests of the people and the country, without a single thought for themselves. So, think of the tasks. Think of the responsibility. Shame on those who only think of their personal comfort, of going abroad, drinking toasts and coming back loaded with foreign-made articles. Last, but not least, I've come to learn that foreign trade plays a substantial role in our national economy. This is done by acquiring from abroad the equipment and technical know-how necessary for our modernization drive, and by pushing the sales of our exports, which form the material basis of our imports. There are so many new fields to open up, and so many new things to be learned. 4 or 5 years is not enough. It requires more than one's lifetime. As a student of foreign trade, I feel that my future job is just as significant and necessary as many other occupations, like the geologists conquering the deserts, the scientists tapping the ocean, and the astronauts exploring outer space. Instead of going abroad, I may be asked to sit at my desk all my life, collecting data, translating or interpreting. Then, am I a lucky dog? Yes, I am lucky that I've become a student of foreign trade, lucky that I'm conscious of the responsibility of a businesswoman of New China, lucky that I have acquired an initial ability to serve my country and my people heart and soul. Text B. Chris, why is it that there are so many different languages, and that in Europe, certainly if you travel more than 100 miles, you're likely to find people speaking a completely different language to your own? Well, it's true to say that there are hundreds and hundreds of different languages. It's perhaps, however, more interesting and more informative to say that there are several different groups of languages. Most European languages, with the exception of, I think, Finnish and Basque and Hungarian, I believe, belong to the Indo-European group of languages. I'm not very sure myself of the actual details of the history of these languages, but you can be very sure that that most of these languages, say Latin and Greek, and our own language, and German, and French, and all the others, are connected. The reason why you can travel from one village to another in Switzerland, and from one area to another in England, and find different dialects, if not different languages spoken, is that several hundred years ago, communication was by word of mouth. Word of mouth meant that people had to move. If people were to move, they needed roads, and there were no roads. Do you see any chance for a universal language like Esperanto? Not for an artificial language, no. I suppose the Roman Catholic Church used Latin, but Latin had a particular religious basis, and this is probably why it was therefore chosen. I don't see very much chance for Esperanto. I think it's an awfully good idea, but I don't believe that language works like that. I think people will probably work towards the most convenient language to use. They will not set out to learn a new language. It seems to me that either English, Russian, or Chinese, perhaps Japanese, will be the language of the future. My bet's on English. Maggie, why do you think that it is that so few English people speak a second language?
I think when you learn a language at school, it tends to be rather a dead occupation, and it's very difficult to stimulate any interest among school children. But when you actually go to the country and spend, say, a month in an exchange visit when you're a schoolgirl or a schoolboy, then you suddenly become more interested because you want to communicate with people when you're actually abroad, and it's not safe to rely on the fact that most people speak English when in foreign countries. I think English people traditionally thought that foreigners always spoke English, and a lot of foreigners do, but there are people that you meet in the street, or you want to take a bus somewhere, then you find that you need to speak their language. And it's very unnerving to be in a situation where you can't communicate with people when you do want to travel around.
Have you ever been abroad and learnt a language in the country?
Yes, well, when I was a secretary, I went and lived in Geneva for 2 years, and I learnt French at school, but I really didn't speak it at all. I knew it theoretically, but I wasn't able to communicate with people. But I was in a situation where if I didn't speak French, then I would not have been able to do my shopping and buy food, and so I picked the language up, and I made friends with French people, Swiss French people, and I found that if I wanted to communicate with all the people that I met, then I had to learn French. And I think it's the best method of learning, because you're in the situation. It's very hard at times. You can sit through dinner parties and not understand what's going on. And you think everybody thinks you're stupid because you can't communicate with them. But it's the hard way, but I think it's the best way to learn.
Elfriede, you come from Austria, and yet you've been living in England now for the last 3 years. Has having to learn and speak another language created great problems?
At the beginning, yes. It was rather difficult for me to get the right job. After you've lived here for 1 or 2 years, you get to know the system, and then that's quite good. You know how to use libraries, and you get to know where to call in emergencies. You get to know trying to get a radio and understand the radio and all the programs they have. and when they're on, and the little stories.
What about English humour on the radio?
I think that it takes a very, very long time to understand, and I'm sorry to say that I haven't managed yet to understand it completely. But, I find it very interesting to speak other languages, because English people have different, have a different mentality, and have a very different character, and a different temperament, and it is fascinating for me to talk to them. And also for myself, to be able to express myself in a different language and to communicate with them.
Additional information. Sometimes I can't help thinking how magic languages are. They're like bridges joining islands, connecting people's minds. Now, whenever I am in the classroom, at lectures or practicing English or French, I often think of my experiences at the 11th Asian Games held in Beijing last autumn. I was assigned interpreter to the sports delegation from the Maldives, a small island country in the Indian Ocean. When I met the delegation at Beijing Airport, I was greatly surprised to find they all spoke English fluently. We were so excited when we realized that we were talking to each other in a language that was not native to either of us. During the games, one of my delegation, Xia Jiao, developed some eye trouble. The game's village doctor thought it was infectious and said he should go to the infectious diseases hospital, and I was asked to take him. A Sikh from the Indian delegation went with us. He was suspected of having hepatitis. At the hospital, I helped the doctor and nurse get Xia Jiao settled down. The next day, the hospital called to say that Xia Jiao's eye trouble was not serious and there was no need for him to stay in hospital, so I immediately went to fetch him out. We were about to leave the hospital when a nurse hurried over to me. "Are you the interpreter?" she asked. "Yes. Could you please help us? The Indian patient you brought in with you yesterday, you know, we can't communicate with him. Nobody in the hospital speaks English." "All right. Let's see if I can be of help." Xia Jiao and I followed her to the Sikh's ward. Three doctors and nurses were around his bed, trying to get through to him with gestures and a few English words. They were very relieved to see me. I asked the Indian, "Can I help you?" But he replied in a language I had never heard before. "English! English! Don't you speak English?" I asked. It seemed he knew the word English, for he shook his head. I didn't know what to do now. It was beyond me. Then Xia Jiao started speaking in a strange language. It was so funny. How come? The native tongue in the Maldives is Dvihi, certainly not a language in India. Xia Jiao turned to me and said, "My parents come from India. I speak a little Hindi." That was great. The examination started. The doctors told me in Chinese what they wanted to know. I translated it into English. Xia Jiao told the patient in Hindi. The Sikh answered in Hindi. Xia Jiao told me in English, and I put it into Chinese for the doctors. The examination took a full hour. The doctors and the patient were very happy, for at last they could communicate with each other. When all the questioning was over, the doctor who seemed to be in charge took my hand and Xia Jiao's hand and said in Chinese, "Thank you very much." Then the patient smiled at me and said, "Thank you." Thank you. It was such an exciting and stimulating experience. I felt how good it was to be an interpreter. Lesson 35. Never give up the hope of living. Text A. In this recorded conversation with a friend, Alison Wilson described her reactions to the news that she was going to die of cancer. The conversation took place 5 months before her death. Firstly, I told myself, "The thing has happened. However much you fuss and scream and yell, it's not going to change." I realized I'd got to discipline myself. Another thing was, I remembered the vicar of a church I used to go to saying that this kind of thing was often much harder for the relatives than for the patient. So here there was scope for me to do something positive. Thirdly, just before I left the hospital, I came across two young women in their 30s, both with small children and both with cancer. I thought, well, what am I worrying about, because my children are grown up and independent. If I can get this right for myself and make some sort of peace with it, then the people who love me will also accept it, and this needn't be too bad a time. Of course, it wasn't as simple as that. When I came out of hospital, I found I was getting it wrong with quite a lot of people, because they didn't look at it the same way as I did. And again, I think if you're going to die around the age of 50, far more people are involved than if you're dying when you're really old. You know, it's fairly threatening to people of your own age. They see you in the middle of a fairly busy life suddenly stopping, and they find it unacceptable. This business, again, of getting them to give me permission to die. Several of my friends still feel very angry and bitter about it and just won't accept it. In consequence, they tell me I shouldn't accept it. I get all these stories about these heroic people who have organ after organ removed and say, "I'm not going to die, I'm going to live." And they go on year after year. It makes me feel I'm being terribly feeble. I feel rather guilty, as if what they're saying is, well, you're not trying hard enough. I can't really see what else I could be doing. I'm very confused about all this. I don't quite understand what I ought to do. Well, I suppose one could be a Chichester and rush across the Atlantic in a boat, but, you know, really I'm too tired for that. I think what I want to say to people is that if you're in this situation, it isn't nearly as bad as people who try and put themselves in your position think it is. For one thing, other people come to it cold, whereas I've been doing my homework on it for the last 2 years. I've got used to the idea and have come to the point of acceptance gradually. The other thing is that they're feeling well and vigorous, with lots of things they're in the middle of doing. But I'm actually getting very tired and don't feel very well. The fact that I can't drive my car and I'm generally having to cut down my activities isn't as bad for me as they think it is. I try to get this through to people and it seems to release their anxiety a bit. My friends are beginning to accept what is happening and come along with me. It's been a time for thinking about relationships and sorting out those which weren't very satisfactory. Also, to a large extent, the pressure is off and you're going to die. You don't really have to do much. It's rather a relief if you're not feeling well. I've been very happy these last 6 months. I used to think that if you knew you were dying, there would be a great black pool over everything, and nothing could be of any value. But it isn't like that. In some ways, even, you get increased appreciation of things. Colours are brighter, and little pleasures mean more. You almost get another dimension. I feel that if I hadn't understood what was happening and come to terms with it, this would have been lost. So if you asked me whether I would rather have a coronary or what I've got, I would rather have this because I've had all this good time. And I feel sad because other people might have it, but miss it, because they aren't allowed to come to terms with what's going to happen, or don't feel able to. And this is such a waste. Text B. Wang Jinghui is a lecturer in China Textile University in Shanghai. Now, at the age of 53, he is about to leave this world. In July last year, he was diagnosed as to be suffering from cancer in the esophagus. The doctor told him that there might still be a slight chance for him if he got operated on at once, as the cancer was already in an advanced stage. The news greatly alarmed Wang and his daughter, who had accompanied him to the hospital. Naturally, they wanted to have an operation at once, as there was not a moment to be lost. "But all our wards are full at the moment," the doctor told them. "How long do we have to wait, then?" the daughter asked. "At least 2 months. We have a long waiting list." Back home, the daughter was at her wit's end. 5 years earlier, her mother had died of cancer. It was her father, then, who had looked after everything. Her mother's operation, then the funeral. And after her mother's death, it was her father who looked after her and her younger sister, and had seen them through school and then college for her. She had just graduated and her younger sister was still at school. How could they do without their father? No, their father must not die. She lost no time and spared no efforts in finding a hospital for her father. She went everywhere and asked everybody, friends, relatives, acquaintances, anyone who might know of a way to, or have connections with a hospital. A few days later, one of her former schoolmates came with the heartening news that one of her friends had a relative who could pull strings with a certain big hospital. And so, this friend's friend's relative made his appearance. He proved to be very helpful and enthusiastic, and promised to see the whole thing through. But he constantly dropped hints to Wang's daughter about the going price for road paving to a hospital. At the hospital, things went as smoothly as he had promised. Wang's daughter had handed him 300 yuan, and soon he had everything arranged, consultation for Wang and registration for living in. He informed them that there would be a vacant bed the following Monday. They went home full of hope. He, the man who had arranged everything for them, began to lay down his cards. The going price is 2,500 yuan, but don't worry, he hastened to add when he saw the alarm in father and daughter's faces. I've managed to bring it down to the bottom line, 1,200, but you have to get it ready soon. I have to satisfy the registration office, the surgeon in charge, the operating doctor and his assistant, the two anaesthetists. Not a single one could be left out. What else could they do? In order to cure her father, the daughter went about and managed to scrape together 500 yuan, which she handed to the man just before her father went to live in. As arranged, Wang entered the hospital on Monday, July the 16th, but more than a week went by and nobody seemed to bother about him, and nothing was mentioned about his operation. Both father and daughter were worried about this endless waiting, and she approached the man again to see if he could speed things up. An operating doctor has yet to be found. She understood what that meant, and as she was almost worried to death, she gritted her teeth and produced another 400 yuan. Apparently the man meant what he said when he mentioned 1,200 as the bottom line. On July the 28th, Wang finally was wheeled into the operation theatre, but he was not kept there for long. The doctor opened up his chest and found that cancer had reached such a stage as to make an operation impossible. So merciless was the hand of fate. When a reporter from Xinmin Evening went to see Wang early this year, she found an emancipated man lying in bed, obviously nearing his last. He could hardly produce a coherent sentence, but he kept repeating, "We've been robbed of 1,200 yuan. Now we are penniless. What is going to happen to my two girls?" The daughter said, "What happened to us was far from unique. It has become quite a common practice for patients to pay through their noses in order to live in. All the same, I want our story to be told. Not that I have any illusions about getting our money back." Additional information. Not long ago, an unusual wedding was held in Beijing's Yuyuantan Park. Both the bride and bridegroom suffered from cancer, but had made surprising improvement with the aid of Qigong, a traditional Chinese healing system that relies heavily on breathing exercises. It is also through Qigong that the young couple met and fell in love. The 28-year-old Guo Chengpei was formerly a top player on the Beijing table tennis team, but after participating in the first Pyongyang International Table Tennis Invitational Tournament in September 1981, he felt his health declining and he could hardly talk. After an examination, he was diagnosed as having lung cancer, which is usually fatal. He had to stop training and undergo treatment. Because Guo's cancer had spread to his lymph nodes, it was inoperable. The radiation treatment he received helped little. His doctor predicted that, despite his youth, Guo had only 3 months to live. However, being trained as a table tennis player for 12 years, he had an unyielding will and an optimistic attitude, and he did not give up hope. One of his friends suggested that he practice Qigong, which is credited with prolonging many cancer patients' lives. This strengthened his will to surmount the disease. He took his friend's advice to practice Guolin Qigong, a combination of moving and breathing, every day. Getting up at 2:45 a.m., he took the night shuttle bus to Reton Park and started his routine at 3:40 a.m. He practiced for more than 5 hours. His father and uncles took turns accompanying him. With his strong will and indomitable perseverance, he has kept practicing Qigong for 7.5 years, in all kinds of weather. A check-up in 1987 showed that the lung cancer spread to the lymph nodes had disappeared and the tumor was reduced in size. His weight has increased from 60 to 85 kilograms. He has become fitter and his general health has improved. His 26-year-old bride, Chen Yamai, became ill with thymoma in September 1985. When I was told that I had cancer, I felt the future looked so dark and miserable that I was in despair, she said. In December that year, she had an operation. Afterwards, she received chemical and radioactive treatments, but little effect could be seen. The cancer began to spread to the lymph nodes and bones. While she was hospitalized, she often saw patients around her die. She was terribly frightened, and she felt on the brink of death herself. In June 1986, she heard that Qigong could help cure cancer. Though she didn't completely believe it, she saw a glimmer of hope and decided to try it. She also went to Rethan Park to learn Qigong and was assigned to the class that was instructed by Guo Chengpai. Everyone in my Qigong class looks vigorous and energetic, Chen said. There is no sign that they have had the deadly disease. It gives me confidence and courage to live on. She often sought advice from Guo, and he always helped her patiently and enthusiastically. They shared experiences and encouraged each other. At last, love blossomed in the young couple's hearts. After 3 years of constant Qigong practice, Chen's condition is stable. Now she says she has a better appetite and sleeps more soundly. Curing cancer through Qigong had a scientific basis, Guo said. The growth of cancer cells is restrained when one breathes plenty of oxygen. After one properly practices Qigong for quite a long time, he is able to greatly enlarge his respiratory capacity. This is good for cancer patients. Drawing on his own experience, Guo thinks that combinations of Qigong, Western medicine, and traditional Chinese medicine are the best way to conquer cancer. And he said a wholesome psychological outlook is the most important thing. Everyone suffering from cancer should think like this. Even if the survival rate in cancer is only 0.1%, I am the 0.1%, Guo said. Those who can get better the fastest are those who are strong in spirit. The couple hope that all cancer patients love life and never lose their hope of living.
听力课堂，欢迎你。
听力课堂，欢迎。
听啊，讲啊。